From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org. You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
According to today's first guests, there's good news for anyone who's ever looked up at the stars and felt insignificant. Joel R. Primack, a professor of physics at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and Nancy Ellen Abrams, a lawyer of science policy, have come up with a view of the universe in which humans figure more prominently than anyone has suggested in the past 400 years. And they explain it all in The View from the Center of the Universe, Discovering Our Extraordinary Place in the Cosmos, which is published by Riverhead Books. I'm very pleased to welcome them to my show today. Hello.
Hello,
Thanks
Leonard.
For having us.
Well, for most of human history, humans thought that we were at the center of the universe and that everything revolved around us, at least until Copernicus and Galileo changed all that. Are you saying that the ancients were right after all?
In an interesting way, they were. They had understood that by seeing ourselves as central to the cosmos, we feel important and we take seriously our own actions. For the last 400 years, it's been impossible to think of ourselves as central to the universe because our concept of central was a geographical concept, and it's true. Galileo was, of course, right. Earth is not the center of the universe geographically. But what is astonishing is that a new picture of the universe is emerging now, a completely new picture, so different it's on the same level as the Copernican Revolution. We're now understanding how the universe really evolved and came about. And in the underlying principles of this new picture, it turns out that we are central in multiple ways, but subtle and interesting ways, making it possible to see ourselves as central if we choose to.
Joel, aren't you one of the principal originators and developers of the theory of cold dark matter?
Yes. In fact, I also invented the name.
In a little while I'll ask you to explain what it is, but has your thinking in that area led you to some of the ideas you propose in this book?
It was really more teaching it. Nancy and I have been teaching an undergraduate course at the University of California, Santa Cruz for the last decade. And as we have been teaching it, and also, for that matter, together with my scientific colleagues working out this story and checking it against the wonderful new data that we're getting from telescopes, we've realized that the more we look at the universe from where we stand in it, in the inside, the more central or special we appear. For example, we're at the center of all possible sizes. According to modern physics, there's a smallest size. It's determined by the interplay of relativity and quantum mechanics. And, of course, there's a largest size, namely the visible universe. And we're right in the middle between those two sizes, and there's no other size that intelligent creatures could be. Any intelligent life we find in the universe is likely to be pretty close in size to ourselves. We're at the center of time. We're at the center of the history of the universe in the sense that the universe is undergoing a transition now from the way it's been for many billions of years to the way it's going to be probably for the indefinite future. But also we're at the middle of the age of the solar system. We're about halfway through the ordinary lifetime of a star like our sun. And we're in the middle of the best period of Earth when it has an oxygen-rich atmosphere.
But if, as you kind of said there is a possibility of life in other places, why wouldn't that intelligent life, if it's intelligent or even if it's just a couple of molecules, have an equal claim on
it
being
does.
The center of the universe?
It has exactly an equal claim. And when we say we don't mean just we humans. We mean we intelligent creatures. It's intelligence that defines us as being central.
How did a cosmologist come to team up on a book with a science policy lawyer? who also, as I understand it, is a songwriter and a science philosopher.
Well, we're married, first of all. That helped. And but, of course,
well,
we
got
married.
That could be problematical as well on doing a collaboration.
It could, but we met each other because of our common interests. We met each other in Washington, D.C. We were both doing science policy in the late 70s, and we ran into each other at a meeting. So we were already sharing interests then.
And did you discover in over the years that you shared certain ideas about the nature of the universe that could lead you to teach that course and then write this book?
It wasn't so much that we shared ideas. It was that we shared questions. We really wanted to understand how our picture of the universe, which, of course, Joel has been working on this for decades now. This was not an easy thing to figure out, what the entire universe is made of and how it all works. And I've been following this series of discoveries. I've been attending the conferences. I have a background in history and philosophy of science, so I started out not exactly at ground zero. And we've really wanted to understand, all right, if the universe is this strange new counterintuitive picture, and we are here, we're demonstratively here, we're part of the universe is right here on our size scale as well as all other size scales, how do we fit in? Because you can't actually have an accurate picture of the universe if you think of it as something out there, far out there, and we can stand back and study it objectively. Just by taking yourself outside the universe, you've made your picture inaccurate. So for a really complete picture of the universe, you have to put us into it. And how do we do that? That was the question.
You seem to suggest that Newton played a role in taking us out of it.
Well, Newton codified and synthesized the science that had developed in the century and a half before him, starting with Copernicus.
He came up with a mechanical universe, didn't he? In which everything was in balance and everything. It was almost like a machine that worked perfectly. Am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. As I say, he was the synthesizer. We wouldn't have had a mechanical universe if it hadn't been for machines. In some sense, this idea of the universe as a machine is based on what was the greatest technological achievement of the Middle Ages, which was the clock. It was monks who invented clocks, and they did it, ironically, so that they could synchronize prayers in monasteries across Europe. They thought God would hear them better. But very quickly, the clock became secularized. It became the basis of the regulation of work hours. And before very long, instead of being paid by the piece, people were being paid by the hour. Of course, you had to have some kind of regular work hours for that to make sense. But this basic idea of the universe as a machine was the universe as clockwork. And many scientists, including Newton, basically took that as their metaphor. It replaced an earlier metaphor, which was more a biological metaphor of the universe as a living organism. I think one of the things that's happened as we've learned much more about how the universe really works is that we're coming back to seeing the universe as an organism, but not a biological organism, as an organism that has a history that changes over time and evolves in interesting ways. But now that we're starting to understand it better, we realize that earthly metaphors like clocks or living organisms don't really apply very well.
And you say that the Newtonian metaphors left humans feeling, as you call it, cosmically homeless.
Yes. The problem was that the medieval picture, which everybody in Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East shared, this was the common view of Jews, Christians, and Muslims, was that the Earth was spherical and in the center of a spherical universe, surrounded by crystal spheres carrying the planets, an outer sphere carrying the fixed stars, and beyond that, heaven. In some ways, it was a very comforting picture.
We're in the middle, and then we're at the end of it as well, in heaven.
Right, surrounded by God, and who was watching everything we did.
Well, this
had
is kind
place.
Of mechanistic as well, isn't it?
Well, it wasn't exactly seen as mechanistic, but it's certainly true that in some great sense it was a clockwork because the whole thing turned around to us every single day. which certainly made us feel very central indeed. Now, this entire picture was utterly destroyed once the telescope was used by Galileo to actually look at the heavens in detail. It became clear that none of it made any sense at all. So then where were we? And the answer was, for a long time, no place. And that's what we mean by saying cosmically homeless. We were no place special. It didn't look like there was any real sense to the universe. What people did is they simply extrapolated the solar system.
But even now, we don't really know the shape of the solar system. The shape of the universe, do we? I've seen all sorts of different possible models, and then I've seen models that suggest that there are all these alternative universes that we're just not seeing that are part of what we see.
Well, let me try to separate the two different kinds of theories into the part that we actually know a great deal about and can test, and the part that's essentially sheer speculation. The part that we know about, which is mainly what we try to discuss in our book, is becoming very clear. And I think that the universe has structure and shape on many different size scales. On scales like our planet, of course, you get nice spherical objects. On scales like our solar system, now we've discovered about 200 planetary systems, of which ours is just one. And so we're beginning to learn some of the rules of planetary systems. We're also discovering that ours is a rather extraordinary one.
Although recently, I just read about it in the paper yesterday, I think, another solar system with planets revolving around it, including one that is about the same distance from a sun similar to ours as Earth is.
Well, we're starting to find some that look like ours. But so far, of course, we mainly see big planets. And when we see planets that are about as far from the sun as the Earth is, or about as far as Jupiter is, that's the range that we currently are probing, we usually find that they're on highly elliptical orbits. You'd never get a kind of life that we have in a planetary system like that. The climate would just be too unstable. But anyway, we're at least starting to understand something about the rules of making planetary systems. And so it's not sheer speculation as it was until about 10 years ago. We really understand now, I think, how galaxies came into existence. There's a lot more that we need to fill out in that picture, and that's a great adventure that we're having today. But we understand something about galaxies, and we also can see very clearly how the galaxies themselves are organized into clusters and superclusters. And beyond the scale of superclusters, it seems that the universe becomes very uniform.
And why the last 10 years? Because of the Hubble or because of just the way certain problems have been resolved recently?
I think that the single most important thing has been the data. It's partly Hubble Space Telescope. I'd say that of all the telescopes that we have had in the whole history of astronomy, that Hubble Space Telescope has been the most important.
And we're going to scuttle it.
I certainly hope we don't.
Well, isn't that what I've been told?
Sean O'Keefe, the former administrator of NASA, declared right after President Bush announced the Moon-Mars Initiative in January of 2004 that it was not going to be possible to repair Hubble for reasons of safety of the astronauts. That was total bunkum. It's been denounced by the astronauts and by the scientists who studied this under the auspices of the National Academy of Sciences. And I think it's one of the reasons that Sean O'Keefe resigned as the administrator of NASA. The new administrator, Mike Griffin, has made it one of his highest priorities to repair Hubble. We're going to have to visit Hubble again one way or another because the people who built Hubble did not provide it with retro rockets. In fact, not only doesn't it have a way of re-entering the atmosphere under control, the gyros are failing, and we're going to have to put rockets on it and also fix the gyroscopes in order to bring it down safely. And that could either be done with robots or else it could be done with astronauts. We've had a lot of experience with the astronauts. The astronauts would love to do this.
So why not just fix it?
Well, clearly we're going to have to. And the National Academy study concluded that trying to do it with robots would be very dangerous because you can't train robots nearly as fast as you can train astronauts. If we're going to visit it again, we scientists would love to install the two new instruments that have been built and waiting to be installed, which will give Hubble a wonderful 10 more years of life. So we're all hoping that we can get the shuttle flying again and that sometime soon revisit Hubble Space Telescope and fix it for another good 10 years. But it's all the other telescopes. It's this whole fleet of telescopes. Especially important, the telescopes that have given us an extremely detailed view of the heat radiation of the Big Bang. It's taken all together that this data gives us a real picture, a very detailed picture of how the universe has evolved. We see snapshots of it at every stage. And that's allowed theorists like me, working with also a new generation of supercomputers, the ability that we have now to simulate the universe works hand in hand with our ability to see it and to envision it theoretically. And so we have these three legs of our tripod, and now we have, I think, a very stable view. There's also this very speculative stuff about the multiverse and so on.
And we'll get to
people should understand that's sheer speculation. We have actually no evidence behind that at all.
And now something much more mundane. Have I been mispronouncing your name?
Well, Premack is how my dad
pronounced it. Joel R. Premack is here, professor of physics at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And Nancy Ellen Abrams, a lawyer, philosopher. And they have collaborated on The View from the Center of the Universe, published by Riverhead Books. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Joel R. Premack, professor of physics at the University of California, Santa Cruz, who specializes in the formation and evolution of galaxies and the nature of the dark matter that makes up most of the matter of the universe, and Nancy Ellen Abrams, who is a specialist in the history and philosophy of science, as well as a lawyer, and they have collaborated on a book called The View from the Center of the Universe, published by Riverhead. You do science mediation, Nancy, don't you? In collaborating on a book, no matter how close you are to the person you're working with, I know there are always problems. Did some of those mediation skills come into play?
No, not at all. Science mediation is a different kind of thing that I have done in the past, where this is a technique that's used to get coherent science advice for a government agency, where the scientists are in dispute about what the facts are. And the people making the decision are usually lawyers like me and don't know how to evaluate a scientific dispute. When I used to work on the staff of the Congress, this thing came up all the time. And the sad result was that the decision makers would simply ignore the scientists and decide on the basis of politics. So it was clear to me that we needed a protocol.
And hasn't that been happening a lot more recently? We've heard many complaints from scientists that politics have been playing a major role in scientific decisions, at least coming out of Washington.
No, it's different today. It's much worse.
We
thought in the 70s we were having a problem when this first started, because there would be science advisors, the president would attempt to understand why there was a dispute and not be able to understand it. But now we have a president who simply doesn't care what the scientists say and simply immediately just goes to the political.
But if you also just check out the attitudes of the American public, you find that an overwhelming majority believes the biblical story of the creation of the universe. And I wonder who you're even talking to here with this kind of advanced scientific and philosophical theory.
You know, I don't believe those polls. I cannot believe that 50% of Americans believe that the universe was created 6,000 years ago. There's so much evidence. The evidence is everywhere. It's in the fossils. It's in the stars. It's in the galaxies. I don't believe people really believe that. Maybe they say it for personal reasons or to be on the right side of other people. I don't know. That's not the point. We are speaking the truth, and those people who are interested in understanding what nature has to say to us are going to have to pay attention to the truth. And sooner or later, the truth always wins out. So I think more people will catch on.
But in talking about this, can we say that your model of the universe is based more on physical evidence or on a philosophical construct?
Entirely based on physical evidence. What we're saying here is that we have a new picture of the universe. It is as different a picture as the Copernican Revolution picture was from the medieval picture. This is really a cosmological revolution. And the real question now becomes, we know what the universe is like on the great scale. We know that it's completely different from what most people think. How can we communicate that to people? This is everyone's universe. It's not just the universe of specialists. How do we get that across? And the goal of our book has been to try to figure out how to present this new picture visually through pictures, symbols, guided meditations, stories, and not just to make it easier, but because this is the way that all earlier cosmologies were communicated. If you want a cosmology to become the foundation of your culture, and that is what it has to be a shared cosmology, and to have a culture that has a unifying theme, it has to be presented in such a way that people feel that they are part of it. You cannot give people a story that they're not part of and expect them to be interested in it. And it's also not true.
One of your areas of interest is in myths, and
yes,
pretty much every culture has its cosmological myth, doesn't it?
That's right.
So is spirituality a factor here? Your publisher keeps on insisting that spirituality is a part of what you're dealing with in this book.
Spirituality, as we see it, yes, is definitely involved. But different people have different definitions of spirituality. We are talking about the kind of spirituality that is not part of any particular religion. To us, spirituality is the way that a person relates to the cosmos, not the way they study the cosmos. The study of the cosmos is science, but how we relate, how we experience it, how we feel ourselves part of it, to us, that's spirituality. So our book is definitely about that, and we'll have some implications for that. We really feel that if this modern picture could just be expressed mythologically, that is, in a story in which we're participants, that people would get it and that it would really change our society and give us a foundation for the kind of vision that we're going to need to overcome the immense challenges of the next few decades. We don't have a unifying picture right now. The only thing, in our opinion, that could possibly be the foundation of a unifying picture is science.
My guests are Nancy Ellen Abrams and Joel R. Primack, who have collaborated on a book called The View from the Center of the Universe, Discovering Our Extraordinary Place in the Cosmos, published by Riverhead Books. This is WNYC 93.9 AME 20. We're online at WNYC.org. You also point out in this book that we're all made of stardust.
Yes.
That humans are actually composed of all of the things that have come through stardust. And perhaps there's a spiritual aspect to that realization, isn't there?
You know, it's a scientific fact, but when you start to feel the meaning of this fact that 90% of the atoms in our bodies right now were actually manufactured in stars millions of years ago, and then those stars exploded and those atoms went flying through the universe and got picked up into the gravitational field of some newly forming solar system and gradually evolved over billions of years into us. That's in us. That history is in us. And in some sense, I suppose it feels like a spiritual revelation, but really all it is a scientific fact.
Things have changed a lot in recent years. I guess the first thing that shook me up was the realization that the universe is expanding at an ever-increasing speed, which just goes against everything that seems logical. Is that how you got involved in your exploration into cold, dark matter?
No. The realization that the universe is increasing its expansion rate is something that we've only known for sure for the last 8 years. We've known that it was a possibility for a good deal longer.
But Einstein posited it and then said right. It was the worst mistake he ever made.
Well, that's right, but the actual story is fairly complicated. When Einstein first invented our modern picture of space-time and gravity, which we call relativity, more precisely general relativity, the more advanced form of the theory, he did this in November of 1915. That's when he pulled the whole thing together, very quickly, actually. He applied it to the whole universe in a few months later, and he realized that it meant that the universe couldn't be static. It had to either be expanding or contracting. So he asked his astronomer friends, is the universe doing something like that? And as far as the astronomers knew, it wasn't. So Einstein thought and thought, and he realized that he'd made one extra assumption that he didn't have to make when he invented general relativity. And if he relaxed that assumption, he realized that you could add an extra term to the theory, which he called the cosmological constant. And that, he thought, maybe could give you a static universe. It's a kind of a cosmic repulsion. It's a repulsion of space by space. It has nothing to do with matter. And the idea was that that could counteract the natural gravitational attraction of matter and stabilize the universe. It turns out it doesn't work. But what people later found out about 1929 was that actually the universe is expanding. And that's when Einstein said, I should never have gone down that road. If I had just believed the theory and not put in this extra piece, Einstein thought, then I would have predicted that the universe is expanding or contracting, and that would have been a great triumph for the theory. When a great genius like Einstein makes a mistake, however, it's often a mistake of genius, and this was one of those mistakes. And now we realize that the cosmological constant, or something very much like it, which we call dark energy as a kind of generalization, is actually the dominant form of stuff in the universe. So I think that the thing that was most shocking was not that the universe has this dark energy. I mean, that's pretty shocking, I agree. But what shocked me was the realization that most of the stuff in the universe isn't anything like the stuff we know. The stuff we're made of, and that the Earth is mostly made of, is stardust. It's heavy elements. And we naturally assume the universe is like what we see around us. Wrong. The universe is nothing like Earth. But maybe it's like the sun. The sun is mostly made of hydrogen and helium, with only a percent or so of the heavier elements. Wrong again. All the stars, all the galaxies, everything that we can actually see represents about 0.5%, 0.5% of what's out there. The other 99.5% is invisible. That was shocking. It's taken astronomy a while to come to terms with that. And the first thing we've realized is that about a quarter of the total is some kind of invisible stuff that's not made of atoms. It's not made of anything that has to do with atoms. And that's what holds the galaxies together. That's what made the galaxies come into existence. The other 70% or so is this dark energy. And all the atoms taken together are probably less than 5%, of which we see about a tenth, 0.5%.
Again, it goes against logic that it's not made of atoms. Something could be made of something other than atoms. Or would it be made of subatomic particles?
That's our best guess. And in fact, many people think it's a particular version of that story that Heinz Pagels and I cooked up back in the early 1980s. The favorite theory that we physicists have to go beyond our standard picture is called supersymmetry. According to supersymmetry, for every kind of particle we've actually discovered so far, there's another kind of particle that we haven't discovered yet. We call those super partners. They must be very massive, otherwise we'd have made them already in our accelerators. If that's correct, and if there's one more rule that comes from supersymmetry that's correct, then the lightest of these super partners should be stable. It should not be able to decay into anything. In the early universe, there was an immense amount of energy available, so all the super partners would have been made, and they would have decayed into the lightest one, and the lightest one would still be around. It would not be any of the particles we know and love. It would be something else. And that would be the dark matter. That's what Pagels and I pointed out back in 1982. And since so many people like the idea of supersymmetry, if you've heard of string theory, that's superstrings. It's based on supersymmetry. So if superstring theory is right, then very likely this is the right story. But we don't have any evidence for it yet, so I want to emphasize that although many people think this may be right, of course I'm hoping it's right, after all I proposed it, until we actually have some evidence, we aren't going to know. We're going to have this new accelerator turn on in Geneva in July of next year. If that has enough energy, it's going to start making these particles in abundance, and we're going to know very quickly what's going on.
So this is typical of scientific exploration. We see a problem. We come up with a theory, and sometimes the theory proves to be right, or at least lead us in the right direction. And often it is not. Even now, people don't agree on whether string theory is a possibility or not, although I think most theorists are going along with it until something better comes along. Is that true?
Like this theory of the multiverse, sometimes called eternal inflation, you should understand there's simply not a shred of evidence in favor of string theory. There's one little piece of evidence in favor of supersymmetry. But we're talking about highly speculative stuff. Dark energy, dark matter, that's not speculative. We have huge amounts of evidence that that's right. Once we go off onto the speculative direction of string theory and eternal inflation and the multiverse, we're really talking about something else. We're talking about hopes, vague theories. But our modern picture of cosmology is not that kind of thing. It's based on a vast amount of evidence, and it's a predictive theory. It made all kinds of predictions, which are being tested, and if they weren't basically coming true, I wouldn't be here today talking about it. So it's important to understand, string theory is a very attractive idea. It's the best idea that anybody's had that tries to get a theory that fits everything together. The trouble with string theory is it's very, very complicated, and nobody knows how to test it yet. It doesn't make very definite predictions. Maybe sometime soon we'll get some additional evidence, and that will point us in the right direction, and we can start to see a connection between these very clever ideas and the things we can actually measure. We're hoping that these new accelerators are going to do that, and we're also hoping to get new data from the universe.
I sure hope these new accelerators take care of that problem and some of these other ones, because I'm tired of doing shows on this that are speculative. I'd like to say this is what really is. And maybe we'll do that in, what, in 10 years or so, do you think?
Oh, a lot sooner than that. Again, the accelerator turns on in July of next year, July 1st of 2007.
Alas, not in the United States.
Alas. The United States could have had a machine even more powerful a lot earlier. We started to build it in Waxahachie, Texas, in the administration of George H.W. Bush, and partly because it was in Texas rather than, for example, Arkansas, when Clinton came in, it wasn't a high priority. Also, we were running budget deficits, and the Cold War was over, and I guess the administration thought it didn't need physicists so much. But in any case, the United States abandoned the superconducting supercollider, and I'm very worried that we're now in the process of abandoning another field in which we've traditionally had a tremendous scientific lead, and that's astronomy. We've had a succession of fantastically valuable spacecraft. Hubble Space Telescope is perhaps the most famous, but these many other telescopes that we've put into space and the huge number that we're building on the ground have really led to a complete revision of our understanding of the universe. But there again, we're abdicating our leadership. The Bush administration's program of putting a man on the moon again is taking priority over all of these wonderful new ideas that we have for testing general relativity, for going beyond our current understanding. And if we don't go that way, there are other countries that are very happy to do so. And what's going to happen is that my students and the other American young scientists are not going to get to play the leading role that my generation has been able to play. So I'm very sad that that's the way we're going, and I'm really hoping that we can turn that around.
I've been talking with Joel R. Premack, professor of physics at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and with Nancy Ellen Abrams, who is a specialist in the history and philosophy of science. They have collaborated on a book called The View from the Center of the Universe, Discovering Our Extraordinary Place in the Cosmos, published by Riverhead Books. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.